Chapter 6. Purpose. Digging. Wraithslip. Heat and sparks filled the air of the forge, one hazing it, the other lighting it with fat orange fireflies. Furnaces burned with infernal light, as steel stripped from the Zeta Morgeld was rendered usable. Rivers of molten metal flowed into weapon molds, and iron hands stripped to the waist beat at fire-blackened anvils with shaping hammers. Hissing smoke arose from water that was too old for tempering, and seasoned smiths spoke of weakness being blended into the metal. Soot-stained banners swayed in rising thermals, each one emblazoned with the sigil of a master armorer. The coffered walls of the forge had once been hung with the great works of those masters, warriors who had toiled in its blistering heat to work wonders with metal, booming songs destined to become part of every masterpiece had once echoed from its walls. Now none remained to shake the soot from the banners. The songs were stilled, and few wonders remained. Beyond the muttering smiths, two figures worked at an anvil in a halo of ruddy light. Like the iron hands, both were stripped to the waist, but there the similarity ended. Nykona Sharukin had skin of alabaster white, an albino but for the shock of glossy black hair in a short scalp lock. Angular eyes set in an aquiline profile were pools that reflected little of the furnace light or flaring sparks. Atesh Tarsa was his opposite in every way, dark of skin and red of eye, with a shaven skull like an orb of black obsidian. Much more than Sharukin, the son of Nocturne looked perfectly at home. 2 days still remained until the ships of the Iron Hands would reach the waypoint that Sabik Weyland had identified from the Morgeld's avionics. Sharukin and Tarsa had spent the time since the union of the Iron Heart and the Sisypheum training, sparring, and now forging. Tarsa held a glowing orange sword blade upon the anvil as Sharukin worked a hammer along its length.
"Careful," warned Tarsa. "You will fold the metal at the edges. You've taken 2 days to harden and straighten the steel already. It would be a shame to break it now."
"How is it that an apothecary knows the secrets of steel as well as those of flesh?" asked Sharukin.
"All Nocturne sons have an affinity with smiting. I have only a passing skill."
Even Sharukin's limited understanding of a forge told him that Tarsa was being modest. He knew better than to press the issue. The salamander was a humble warrior, one who was quietly content to let his skills speak for themselves.
"It's more than I have."
"This anvil has more skill than you," said Tarsa,
though there was no malice in his words. He shook his head.
"And to think you were born in a mine."
"I was a salt boy," said Sharukin,
his jaw hardening and the hammer speaking to his deep-rooted anger.
"As soon as I could walk, I was sent to the tidal pools of Lycaeus' deepest caves. Along with 100 other children, I spent my time scraping crystals from the rocks with a blunted mattock. The tool-making factories used it to salt their tempering water."
Tarsa nodded as he turned the blade.
"Salt water conducts heat more efficiently and makes harder steel than pure water. Though in truth, there's few tools need to be that hard. Dangerous work, I imagine."
"It was," said Sharukin. "Children drowned all the time. A surge tide could pour back into a cave without warning. There was a saying that the best salts came from the bones of the dead."
"Enough hammering," said Tarsa,
moving the blade away from Sharukin's blows.
"Any more will turn the edge against you."
The salamander lifted the sword by the point of its tang and sighted down the bevels.
"The symmetry is not perfect, but there is no warp or screw."
"Will it do?"
Tarsa nodded and handed the blade to Sharukin, who wiped it clean before working it smooth with fine-grained pumice.
"Next, polish the blade until it gleams the blue of a summer's gloaming."
I never saw the sun until my 13th year, said Sharokin.
Then think of the blue of 8th Legion Plit.
I'd rather imagine it red with their blood.
That will be when you quench it.
Sharokin nodded and put the blade upon the anvil.
Quenched in a killing thrust. I like that.
If you like, I will fit a grip for you.
I would be honored, Atesh, said Sharokin.
The honor is mine, Nakona, said Tarsa.
Something simple, mind. I'm not given to gaudy weaponry.
2 palm plates of lacquered ebony?
Perfect, said Sharokin. Apologies, my heart is not in the craft this day.
The mission still bothers you?
Sharokin looked over his shoulder at the toiling iron hands. Reed in the steam of their labors and the fire of the furnaces, they were grotesque silhouettes, ogres of the deeps toiling at their forges.
Yes, the mission still bothers me.
You don't think it's a good one?
Asked Tarsa, taking up the pumice and giving the blade an even keener edge.
That's the trouble. It's almost too good, said Sharokin.
An eye for an eye, as a principle of justice, is as old as time itself, said Tarsa. And you must agree it has a certain operatic quality to it.
Operatic?
Said Sharokin with a raised eyebrow.
The 154th Expeditionary Fleet had its share of playwrights and composers of verse among its remembrances. I was privileged to hear a performance of the Symphony of Banished Night, the scene where Cardinal Tang is imprisoned within Nusa Kambagan and his former victims murder him, is one many believe to be a cornerstone of early imperial policy.
Regardless of your appreciation for opera, it's still feeding into what the Iron Hands want to be doing, said Sharokin. And killing Alpharius? Unless I get Fulgrim in my crosshairs again, there's unlikely to be a more perfect mission for the 10th.
It has given our kinsmen purpose, pointed out Tarsa, and a warrior without purpose is a dangerous thing. Violent impulses must be given an outlet, or men bred to kill turn them on themselves. And there are few as prone to violent self-mutilation than the sons of Ferus Manus.
We had a purpose, said Sharokin. We have a purpose. Don't underestimate the damage we and others like us are doing. Those who fight for Medjuson are far more than the sum of their individual efforts.
Well, how can you know that?
Because it's how we won the war against the Overseers. The rats claw and bite the monster's heels until it can't keep going forwards. Eventually it has to turn. And that is when the real killing blow falls.
Surely joining our forces with Medjuson makes us stronger.
No. Gathering our strength when our numbers are so few doesn't make us strong. It makes us vulnerable.
So what are you suggesting?
Sharokin wiped a hand across his brow and rolled his shoulders.
I'm going to see for myself.
See what?
Sharokin grinned. The system's third planet was unlisted in Imperial cartography, which didn't surprise Sabik Weyland. Typical of the Alpha Legion to choose waypoints so far off the beaten track they hadn't even been named. The Sisypheum and the Iron Hearts orbited the third planet, while Weyland sought to break the fiendish encryption securing the Morgeld's astronavigation data. The two innermost planets danced an elliptical path around their star that periodically brought them dangerously close to collision and left them monstrously geologically unstable. All were too hot to support life, though that had nothing to do with their stellar proximity. Corrosive atmospherics had boiled the worlds to death beneath poisoned skies over thousands of years. Had there been life there once? Impossible to know for certain. Perhaps, in another future, one not hijacked by the War Master's treachery, worlds like these might have been explored and their mysteries revealed. Such a future seemed all but impossible now. What hope was there for exploration for its own sake when the drums of war beat at an ever-increasing tempo?
Everything he had learned on Mars told Wayland that the cost of victory over Horus would not be measured in what was won, but in what had been lost. Wayland sighed, rubbing the heels of his palms over his eyes and blinking away the after-images of scrolling alphanumerics. He'd spent the last 36 hours locked in this cell with the Kryptos. The cunning of the Alpha Legion did not surprise him. He'd long known that the 20th Legion were not to be underestimated. The bloody fight to capture the Zeta Morgeld had reminded them all that this Legion of Vipers did not rely solely upon subtle venoms. Freighter Thematica had made no offer to assist his code-breaking efforts. True, it had been Wayland's void tactics that almost killed Thematica, but his continued absence seemed needlessly petty. Locked into its throne and linked to Wayland's cogitators by invasive neural pickups, the Kryptos churned through billions of code permutations with a stream of burbling static. Grating at the best of times, Wayland's nerves were now stretched to breaking point. A concealing hood was drawn up over the creature's gnarled skull. Wayland couldn't see its face, only glistening hints of the raw lesions on its neck. Tarsa had examined the creature's grotesquely hybridized xenobiology, but could find no cause for the lesions. Were they precursors to the fate that had overtaken Medjuson's own Kryptos? Wayland turned away, disgusted by its very existence. There was something disturbingly unwholesome in the animalistic noises it made, something grotesquely and profoundly wrong in the arrangements of its maxillofacial anatomy. No sane force of evolution could have shaped such a creature. This was an abomination, birthed in a chaos of desire and madness. None would gainsay him were he to put a mass reactive through its skull. He would have done so already, but for the fact that it was useful to them. Even Cybus, who could be counted upon to kill anything that didn't fit his rigid idea of the imperial truth, had seen sense in keeping the Kryptos alive. Wayland estimated another 3 hours would see the Kryptos complete its decryption cycle, revealing the Morgeld's ultimate destination. While it did so, Wayland turned his attention to the void log of the battle against the Morgeld and the Malquiant. He'd already used the Kryptos to pull Alpha Legion challenge codes from the Vox passing between the two vessels. But something unusual had caught his eye.
"Now, what are you?" he murmured, studying the battle's electromagnetic fallout.
A trace in a lower spectroscopic bandwidth he would expect to see. Nothing unusual on its own, and probably part and parcel of the violent outpourings of electromagnetism unleashed in a void engagement. But the constancy of the trace was uncommon enough to pique his interest, and suggested something other than weapons discharge. He scrolled back through the battle to find the first incidents of the emission. But with atomic detonations surrounding the warring vessels, and bursts of macro lasers spiking the readings every other microsecond, it was going to take time. He assigned a backscatter subroutine to sift through the radiation spectra as his throat vox chirped with an incoming communication.
"This is Wayland."
"Can you talk?"
"Nykona?"
"Yes." Sharakin's conspiratorial tone spoke volumes, and Wayland immediately switched to a more secure channel. Dreading the answer, he asked,
"Where are you?"
Sharokin eased himself deeper into the shadows of the tertiary axial transit. He let the air of the Iron Heart fill him, gauging whether it would work with him or against him. Hot oils, lubricant, and the breath of toiling machinery. This was a vessel of war. It seethed with bellicose intent. Sharokin felt fury vibrating in its bones. Every vessel had its own unique character, and the defining one of the Iron Heart was, unsurprisingly, anger. Anger and darkness. Power came at a premium on a warship. Where to distribute that power was crucially important. Clearly, Shadrach Medjuson valued other systems over ship-wide illumination, which suited Sharokin perfectly. He had reached the Iron Heart by secreting himself atop a Thunderhawk transporter on a supply run between the two vessels, sealing his warplate against the vacuum and deep cold of the void. In the instant before the craft entered the Iron Heart's supply deck, he launched himself from its back and used micro bursts from his modified jump pack to guide his trajectory towards a ventral battery. From there, it was a simple matter to locate one of the louvered vents used to expel the corrosive residue of weapons fire from the gun decks. Simple for one trained by the Shadow Masters. It didn't hurt that, like the Sisyphium, the Iron Heart was woefully undercrewed. He'd encountered only a few legionaries, and only a handful of grey-skinned thralls who might as well have been sleepwalking for all the attention they paid him. None of them looked up, or even suspected that one of the shadows gliding through the sepulchral iron corridors didn't belong there. Though the two strike cruisers were superficially similar, the internal structure of Medjuson's vessel was markedly different. Sharokin had explored every hidden corner of the Sisyphium, but that proved no help in his exploration of the Iron Heart. Constructed to ancient plans, each ship was unique, and every legion stamped their own traits onto those that bore their colours. But so profound a difference? That raised the hackles of his suspicions. Sharokin slipped onwards through the darkness. Sometimes he used the floor, sometimes the roof spaces. The interior of the Iron Heart was a twisting labyrinth, a mass of intertwined blind alleys and passageways that spiralled back upon themselves. Every wall was seamed with weld scars and fusion arc stitching. The overall impression was of a starship that had been completely rebuilt from the inside out. Nothing in Sharokin's experience was of any help in navigating its interior. Every time he divined one route's solution, two more conundrums presented themselves. He paused in his exploration and opened a secure vox channel, one he'd established before leaving the Sisyphium. A quick burst transmission with an encryption key he'd copied from the Kryptos.
Zabig?
He received an answer with a fractional delay.
This is Wayland.
Can you talk?
Nykona?
Yes.
Where are you?
Aboard the Iron Heart.
Sharokin heard Wayland sigh.
Of course you are. Where else would you be?
You have the structural plans of the Iron Heart, said Sharokin, not posing it as a question. Updates and refit history.
I do, said Wayland. Everything up to Istvan V.
Sharokin pictured Wayland surrounded by blooming entoptics of the vessel's interior.
Link with my armor, said Sharokin. See what I see.
He heard the clicking interface with Wayland's visor.
Done, said Wayland. But break connection before you wraith slip again. Experiencing that over a link almost blinded me last time.
Understood. What do you have on the Iron Heart?
Commissioned in 808.M30, the 10th year of the Great Crusade, as reckoned from Terran sidereal time,
said Wayland.
Keel laid down in the 10th month of the 10th year.
Appropriate.
Some called it a good omen, said Wayland.
I'd be inclined to agree if I believed in things like that. But I was hoping for more immediately useful information.
Wayland wasn't to be discouraged.
Void trials began 6 years after the keel's sounding. Entered operational service 9 months later. 2 centuries of the highest honours, including trophies taken at Gardinal, and also during the compliance of 1544 and the Diasporex scattering. Listed in 10th Legion Fleet Registry as occupying a vanguard position in the Gorgon's Retribution Fleet en route to Istvan V. No record of the Iron Heart exists subsequent to Istvan.
Hardly surprising.
Agreed, said Wayland. What are you hoping to find?
I'm not sure, said Sharokin,
hearing the Iron Heart's plasmic heartbeat but little else. The sense of abandonment was palpable.
This ship is like an ore mine of Lycaeus when its seam was played out.
And where is everyone?
Whispered Wayland in his helm. Just what I was wondering, said Shurikin, moving deeper into the vessel.
Wayland offered commentary on the ship as he saw through the Raven Guard's helm. Shurikin didn't answer, keeping his mind fixed on the arts taught to him in the darkest spaces of the Ravenspire.
You should be approaching the main axial now.
Shurikin nodded as the passageway before him widened, becoming a vaulted narthex with ironwork mesh flooring and panelled walls worked in beaten metal. The external bulkhead was entirely new, a curving arc of fresh welded steel that ran from beneath the level of the floor to a point near the apex of the chamber.
Are you seeing this?
I am, confirmed Wayland. Blast damage from battery fire. And look at the other walls. Mass reactive craters.
Broadside at close range. And then they were boarded.
A common enough fate at Isfahan.
Shurikin nodded. Few enough vessels had escaped the traitor's trap, and even those that broke through the blockades and escaped pursuit were often little more than barely functioning wrecks.
A tough fight, judging by the number of impacts, he said.
Medjuson said his flagship took a beating from the Sons of Horus, said Wayland. Looks like he undersold how much of a beating.
They were lucky to survive.
Luck has nothing to do with Ironhand surviving, said Wayland.
Shurikin grinned, but it fell from his face as he sensed the presence of others. He vaulted onto the wall and sprang up towards the ductwork overhead, rolling over into a perforated conduit run.
What is it? Wayland asked.
Shurikin looked back down the corridor as three warriors appeared, dark shapes against the bare steelwork of the restored bulkhead. Their battle plate grated and hissed, but they walked with the sure swagger of warriors confident in their invincibility. One carried a melter gun, another a Volkite charger. The third carried a weapon that Shurikin didn't recognize, a tubular construction with multiple glass tube barrels that crackled with cerulean fire. They paused in the narthex as though looking for something, and Shurikin had the powerful sense they knew he was there.
How could...
began Wayland, but Shurikin cut the link. The shadows around him expanded, becoming darker than the blackest night, seeming to flow around him, welcoming him into its fulginous embrace. Shurikin knew that was how it would appear to anyone who might actually see him, anyway. To wraithslip was to become one with the darkness, to own the black and let it enfold you. Its embrace was cold and solitary, for it came from a time when there was no light. Years of training in the deepest mines of his birthrock had given Shurikin an affinity with darkness that few beyond his legion could match. To live sightless in the depths, with the black, slithering things closing in at every turn, soon taught a warrior how to hide. He became a ghost, a rumor of movement, and a whisper of belief. One of the Iron Hands glanced up, but looked away just as quickly, convinced by his hindbrain as much as his eyes that he had seen nothing out of place. Shurikin soon left the three warriors behind and felt the darkness melt away as he eased himself into a side passage. He was alone and rolled from the conduit, swinging down to the deck and landing with a barely audible thud of boots on metal.
You're good, I'll give you that, said a voice at the end of the corridor.
Shurikin spun around, dropping to a crouch and automatically reaching for his pistol. He halted his hand a hair's breadth from the grip as he saw the broad-shouldered silhouette.
My ship fought tooth and nail to stay alive after Isfahan, brother Shurikin, said Shadrach Medjuson. Did you really think I wouldn't know when there's an intruder aboard?